You're listening to Air Schooner, listening that moves you. Hosted by Stacy Waite and Scott Winter.
Welcome to Air Schooner. Today the topic is experimentalism, and we're talking to some writers who test boundaries and convention.
That's right. We're talking to poet Lynn Emanuel and fiction writer Amy Bender. We want to blend some of their readings of their new works with what they have to say about blowing up convention.
And let me tell you a little bit about Amy Bender. She's the author of four books, including The Girl in the Flammable Skirt, An Invisible Sign of My Own, Willful Creatures, and The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake. Her fiction has been featured in McSweeney's, The Paris Review, Harper's, and many more publications. She lives in Los Angeles and teaches creative writing at the University of Southern California.
Stacey, I know Lynn Emanuel's had a big impact on you and your career, and Amy Bender has kind of had a big impact on me, too. I remember when I was in grad school and I was reading her first book, The Girl in the Flammable Skirt, for the first time, and realizing that there were places that a writer can go that I didn't realize that they could go before that. It was a really liberating experience.
Yeah, Amy Bender is going to read us a story that kind of shows us some of the places you can go. It's sort of unpredictable and surprising. She's going to read us a new story that's going to go in her next book, and it's called Appleless, as in without apples.
I once knew a girl who wouldn't eat apples. She wove her walking around groves and orchards. She didn't even like to look at them. They're all mealy, she said, or else too cheeky, too bloomed. No, she stated again, in case we had not heard her, our laps brimming with Granny Smiths and red deliciouses, with galas and Spartans and yellow golden globes. But we had heard her from the very first. We just couldn't help offering again. Please, we pleaded, eat, cracking our bites loudly, exposing the dripping wet inside. It's unsettling to meet people who don't eat apples. The rest of us now eat only apples to compensate. She has declared herself so apple-less we feel we have no other choice. We sit in the orchard together, cross-legged, and when they fall off the trees into our outstretched hands, we bite right in. They are pale green, striped red on red, or a yellow and orange sunset. They are the threaded Fujis with streaks of woven jade and beige, or the dark and rosy Rome beauties. Pippins, Pink Ladies, Braeburns, Macintosh. The orchard grows them all. We suck water off the meat, drink them dry. We pick apple skin out from the spaces between our teeth. We eat the stem and the seeds. And for the moment, there are enough beauties bending the branches for all of us to stay fed for a while. We circle around the core, teeth busy, and while we chew, we watch the girl circle our orchard in her long, swishing skirts, eyes averted. The way I try to think of it is there's something that I'm wanting to capture. Like, and sometimes it will feel like maybe a little rabbit, something that I want to feel alive on the page. And I think my feeling is with fiction, I will use whatever I can to capture something that feels alive on the page, to sort of create some kind, or terrarium. That was a metaphor I was using once, which is like, you can, how do you make a little terrarium that the plants will grow in if the plants are the words and they have some kind of active vitality that can transmit to a reader? That's what I would hope for. That's what I want to do. And then it's all about what's working. And for some reason that I can't explain, it seems like more often than not, if I go through that side door, if I go into the world via something magical or heightened or strange or absurdist or whatever, for me, I can access the emotional stuff more clearly. One day we see her and it's too much. She's just so beautiful on this day. Her skin is wide and open as a river. We could swim right down her. It's unbearable to just let her walk off, and all at once we abandon our laps of apples and run over. Her hair is so long and wheat-like you could bake it into bread. For a second our hearts pang for bread, bread. We've been eating only apples now for weeks. We close in. We ring her. Her lips fold into each other. Our lips skate all over her throat, her bare wrists, her empty palms. We kiss her like we've been starving, and she tilts her head down so she doesn't have to look at us. We knead her hair and kiss down the long line of her leg beneath the shift of her skirt. We pray to her, and our breath is ripe with apple juice. You can see the tears start races down her face while our hands move in to touch the curve of her breasts and the scoop of her neckline. She is so new. There are pulleys in her skin. Our fingers all together work their way to her bare body, past the voluminous yards of cloth, past those loaves of hair. We find her in there, and she's so warm and so alive, and we see the tears, but stop? Impossible. We breathe in closer. Her eyelashes brighten with water. Her shoulders tremble like doves. She's weeping into our arms. She's crumpling down, and we're inside her clothes now. Our hands and mouths are everywhere. There's no sound at all but the slip of skin and her crying and the apples in the orchard thumping uncaught, our lunches and dinners and breakfasts. It's an unfamiliar sound because for weeks now we have not let even one single fruit hit dirt. People come in a tight little box, and so it's just getting a little air into that box or pushing down one wall so that they can peer around the corner. But yeah, it's much more like this sense of play that I think a lot of us lose kind of as soon as we enter adolescence. It's kind of trying to go back to that joyousness and that, you know, sandbox feeling. She cries through it all, and when we're done and piled around her, suddenly timid and spent, suddenly withered nothings, she is the first to stand. She gathers her skirts around herself and smooths back down her hair. She wipes her eyes clear and folds her hands around her waist. She's away from the orchard before we can stand properly and beg her to stay, before we can grovel and claw at her small, perfect feet. We watch her walk, and she's slow and proud, but none of us can possibly catch her. We splay on the horizon in a circle instead as she gets smaller and smaller on the horizon. She never comes by the orchard again, and in a week all the apples are gone. They fall off the trees, and the trees make no new ones. The air smells like snow on the approach. No one dares to mention her, but every morning all of our eyes are fixed on the road, waiting, hoping, staring through the bare branches of an empty orchard. Our stomachs rumble, hungry. The sky is always the same sort of blue. It is so beautiful here. It's kind of my belief that you can't really pick your material because you don't know what's going to show up as interesting on the page, so you just have to try and try and try all sorts of things. So I will try whatever, and that if something seems interesting enough for me to continue, then that's the thing that I'll end up working on. But it's not like I can sit down and say, I want to push the envelope, and so I'm going to write about, you know, talking trees or whatever. And then I start to write a story about talking trees, and it's just dumb and flat. And so that's how I know the talking trees don't have a lot of action on the page. And then people say things like surrealist or sometimes magic realist or slipstream, or experimental is a nice one too. I guess I like all the words, but I wouldn't pick one over the other. You know, like slipstream came up a few years ago. Someone did a panel at the LA Times Book Fair under the guise of slipstream, which is a term by the science fiction writer Bruce Sterling. And it's about writing that makes you feel very strange. And I really like that one because it feels like a really wide umbrella.
I love what Bender says there about writing that makes you feel strange. Our next writer on the show today, Lynn Emanuel, certainly creates that effect in her most recent collection of poems, Noose and Hook. Emanuel is the author of three additional books of poetry, The Dig, Hotel Fiesta, and Then Suddenly. She's professor of English at the University of Pittsburgh, and she's going to read her poem, Metamorphosis, which starts with Franz Kafka's epigraph from his short story of the same name. The epigraph goes, "What's happened to me?" he thought.
As for myself, wherever there was a street going indifferently about her business, I was the dog. At first I wept. I became its beatings, shitting on command, bred and bred into more and more of it. I crouched behind its bark, still as a stone axe. I lunged at a greasy picnic on the table of some lawn. I was dog's belonging, dog told me. We were nothing in and of ourselves. We were one fiction abusing another. Unfortunately, the poetry world is both extraordinarily diverse with all these sort of micro ecosystems in it, with all kinds of different, you know, centers and everything bumping up against each other. And it's also very balkanized, so that I do think there are certain poets now who have cornered the market on the word experimental. I certainly don't write out of that aesthetic that, you know, say the language poets write out of. So I like to think it's experimental, but I certainly don't think it's experimental in the way that in the common usage of that, you know, of that word. I woke up in the cave of its crate, in the kennel of its name, the hinges of our jaws locked tight by the muzzle. My nose had become an organ of thoughtfulness. My ears were shells in which the seas of the voices of the world thrashed, and night fell, day rose, the old died, the young went on. One night I lay down, and in the morning I was dog, and my actions were fetched by orders. Fetch, lie down here. Strangeness, you know, sort of connotes a degree of discomfort. One isn't at home in the work. One isn't, you know, one is a stranger to the work. I mean, it's not necessarily the work that is strange, but it makes the reader a stranger to it. And I think all of that is, in a sense, something that I embrace. Shaggy mat of thought, intellect swarming on a leash of woofs. I howled at the door of my own mind, wanting out of that empty house. Because the tide of abstract thought receded, I grew hushed and flat, marooned inside the odd blessings of appetite. And the voices of the masters perched above us said, "You are just a gregarious piece of furniture." The war came and went beyond the bars of my life. I was dog. Then I embraced it. Then I was undone and replaced by it. So I invented a character, but I realized that in doing so, I was not only writing about the issue of poverty on the home front as a war is taking place elsewhere, which is also, you know, for instance, what Langston Hughes writes about with sort of glittering rage in a number of his poems. But not only was I writing about that, I was writing about my childhood. I was writing about my relationship with my mother. So this extraordinary thing was, the farther I pushed myself away from a sort of a certain representation of personal experience, the closer I got to a certain part of it that I had never been able to write about.
Lynn Emanuel talks about going further away in order to get closer, and Amy Bender talks about going through that side door, Stacey.
Yeah, they both remind me of that idea from Emily Dickinson of telling it slant.
Yeah, and they both have many more good ideas like that that you can hear on prairieschooner.unl.edu in the full interviews that Stacey and I did with those authors.
Thanks for downloading Air Schooner. Please join us next time.
Air Schooner is available on iTunes. Sign up now to subscribe. You'll be the first of your hip friends to get the latest episode, and you can download all past episodes all the way back to the premiere show, featuring Nulani Crohor's Irish poetry. Want to enjoy Prairie Schooner on an e-reader? Now you can. Visit Amazon.com to buy the current issue of Prairie Schooner for only $6.99.
Air Schooner is a bi-weekly product of Prairie Schooner and produced with research support from James Redd, Ted Wheeler, and Marianne Kunkel. Production assistants are Catherine Larson and Franny Sprowls. Technical support comes from Rick Alloway of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's College of Journalism and Mass Communications. Air Schooner is produced by Scott Winter and the brainchild of executive producer Kwame Dawes.